Chapter 3. The Dragon and the Sun. In 2017, the closest sunset to the precise astronomical moment of the summer solstice occurs on the evening of June 20th, which is why Santha, Ross Hamilton and I are back at Serpent Mound on that day rather than on the 21st, when the solstice is more often celebrated. Angles, calculations and astronomical software are all very well, but nothing beats direct, on-the-spot observation. Our project on the 20th, therefore, having familiarized ourselves with the site and its surroundings on our first visit on the 17th, is for Santha to fly the drone 400 feet above the great effigy and photograph it at sunset from a point overlooking both its head and the horizon, commanding its field of view so that we can see for ourselves what its alignment is really all about. It's around 3 p.m. and the sky is cloudless, giving us hope of a clear horizon this evening. With more than enough time to spare on what, after all, is the longest day of the year, Ross beckons for us to follow him on a steep, winding path that leads down from behind the coiled tail of the serpent, through dense woods to the base of the ridge on which the great effigy stands. It's such a calm, clear, peaceful afternoon, filled with the sweet notes of birdsong and so poignant a dance of light and shadow between the leaves and the sun, that the three of us fall silent, descending slowly and steadily, just breathing it all in. The path levels out along the bank of Brush Creek, and we follow it towards the northwest. The creek is on our left, and the ridge looms 100 feet above us on our right. Its slope is not entirely overgrown. In places it is sheer, almost a cliff, on which the trees and bushes can get no purchase, and the bare limestone bedrock is exposed. As we walk, Ross goes over the implications of his own investigations into the true age of Serpent Mound. I refer the reader to his masterwork, The Mystery of the Serpent Mound, for full details. In brief, though, his view as to when exactly the effigy was first constructed is not derived from any of the radiocarbon assays or from calculations to do with the azimuth of the summer solstice sunset. Instead, he focuses on the form of the serpent, which he perceives as a terrestrial image of the constellation Draco. I have my own history with Draco, as those who followed my work over the years will know. In my 1998 book Heaven's Mirror, for example, I present evidence that this enormous constellation, widely depicted as a serpent by many ancient cultures, served as the celestial blueprint according to which the temples of Angkor in Cambodia were laid out on the ground, with each temple below matching a star above. The essence of my case is that the notion of as above, so below, expressed in the architecture of Angkor, is part of an ancient, globally distributed doctrine or system that set out quite deliberately to create monuments on the ground all around the world to mimic the patterns of certain significant constellations in the sky. Moreover, since the positions of all stars as viewed from Earth change slowly but continuously due to the phenomenon called precession, it is possible to use particular configurations of astronomically aligned monuments to deduce the dates that they represent, that is, the dates when the stars were last in the celestial locations depicted by the monuments on the ground. This process of constant change unfolds, of course, over a great cycle of 25,920 years, and has nothing to do with the motions of the stars or with the obliquity cycle. Its cause is another quite different motion of the Earth, driven by the contradictory pull of the gravity of the Sun and the Moon. The result is a slow, circular wobble of the planet's axis of rotation at the rate of 1 degree every 72 years, much resembling the wobble of a spinning top that is no longer upright. The Earth is the viewing platform from which we observe the stars, so these changes in orientation cause changes in the positions of all stars as viewed from Earth. To envisage the process, picture the Earth's axis passing through the geographical south and north poles and thence extended into the heavens. The south and north pole stars in any epoch are the stars at which the two tips of this extended axis point most directly. Serpent Mound is in the northern hemisphere, and the north celestial pole is presently occupied by our pole star, Polaris, Alpha Ursae Minoris, in the constellation of the Little Bear. The effect of precession, however, is to cause the tip of the axis to inscribe an immense circle in the heavens over the cycle of 25,920 years. Thus, around 3000 BC, just before the start of the Pyramid Age in Egypt, the pole star was Thuban, Alpha Draconis, in the constellation of Draco. At the time of the Greeks, it was Beta Ursae Minoris. In AD 14,000, it will be Vega. Sometimes, in this long cyclical journey, the extended north pole of the Earth will point at empty space, and then there will be no useful pole star. As one of the notable circumpolar constellations, and also one of the most widely recognized and one of the oldest for which written records have survived, what makes Draco particularly significant and remarkable was summed up in 1791 in two lines from a poem by Charles Darwin's grandfather, the physician and natural philosopher Erasmus Darwin. With vast convolutions, Draco holds the ecliptic axis in his scaly folds. This ecliptic axis, astronomers today call it the pole of the ecliptic, is the still fixed point in the celestial vault around which the vast circle of the north celestial pole makes its endlessly repeated 25,920-year journey. It is the one place in the sky that never moves or changes, while everything else about it dances and shifts. And once you recognize it for what it is, nothing less than the very heart of heaven, it's striking how the serpentine constellation of Draco seems to coil protectively around it. If at Angkor that constellation was honored in the form of temples laid out in its image on the ground, then I could see no reason in principle why a similar project should not have been mounted in North America. In one case, the medium was stone, with temples targeting the equinox sunrise. In the other, it was a great earthwork, targeting the summer solstice sunset. In both cases, the result was a symbolically powerful union of ground and sky, a union, according to Ross Hamilton, that was made manifest not 1,000 years ago, nor even 2,300 years ago, but around 4,800 to 5,000 years ago. That was the time when Thuban in Draco was the pole star. And at that same remote date, almost 1,000 miles to the south in Louisiana, a site now known as Watson Brake was built. I will have a great deal more to say about Watson Brake in Part 5. As we shall see, it is indisputably 5,000 years old in its present form, and it is Ross's argument that the same mysterious and as yet unidentified group of Native American geometers and astronomers who made Watson Brake also made the great Manitou at Serpent Mound. As usual in these matters, however, there's complexity and nuance behind the headlines. So yes, Ross is of the view that a major project was undertaken at Serpent Mound around 5,000 years ago. But as we talk now, he clarifies what for him is obviously an extremely important point. I always make an effort not to give people the impression that 5,000 years ago is when the first mound structure was built on this spot, he says emphatically. I believe it was a sacred place, with a structure upon it, its connection to the solstice recognized long before, but that it was remade, renovated, and renewed around 5,000 years ago, reinforcing the worn-down traces of older foundations unrealized by conventional dating methods. So there was something here already, a legacy from much earlier times, but 5,000 years ago or thereabouts, a very well-developed version of the current serpentine effigy was created as an active, fully functioning Manitou. In accord with Native American legend and mythology, it would have been outfitted with the necessary accoutrements to facilitate Earth-sky interaction phenomena, quite similar to the way some feel the Great Pyramid and its two sibling pyramids once operated. The Cherokee say there was once a powerful crystal mounted at the head of the serpent, a crystal mentioned in Mooney's 19th-century collection of Cherokee myths. That crystal put out a brilliant light that sullied the meridian beams of the sun. As the story goes, the crystal was stolen, and afterward the people fell into darkness. They revisited the former residences of their godly forebears, whom they held in highest regard, and gradually took away relics of the remaining parts of the serpent as well, leaving only dirt. Then they started taking the dirt also, until the culture that archaeologists call the Adena decided to stop the practice and refurbish all the old sites with fresh earth and stone to ensure they would survive and that the people would have a living testament to the former glories of their ancestors. This reclaiming of the old holy sites began around 2,500 to 2,300 years ago, in other words, 2,500 years after the creation of the Manitou, and continued until around AD 500, when everyone mysteriously vanished or went their separate ways to look for other places in the Mississippi Valley to refurbish. The ancient country of Manitouba was vast, and so there were plenty of other sites to fix up and rededicate. Hence an explosion of remarkably adept architectural masterpieces all throughout much of the Great South and of the Mississippi as we approach the historic period, returning full circle to Ohio. In this model, the same wave of inspiration refurbished the Manitou twice, the refurbishments 1,400 years apart, making it the oldest and youngest, the Alpha and Omega of the Ohio Valley antiquities. As Roth speaks, I've been doing the mental arithmetic. So, I say, the Fort Ancient work at Serpent Mound 1,000 years ago was the second of these restoration projects. That's right, Roth replies, as hopefully everyone, even the archaeologists involved in wrongly attributing the mound solely to the Fort Ancient culture back in 1996, are now beginning to realize. The Manitou and the Megalith. Deep in conversation, we've walked along the bank of Brush Creek at the base of Serpent Mound Ridge to its northwestern end, where it comes to a point naturally targeting the summer solstice sunset. Trees and bushes cover everything here, except the snout of the ridge itself, which thrusts a gnarled and weathered limestone cliff forward through the green veil, revealing an overhang and hints of caves. Ross stops and holds up a hand. "Do you see it?" he says. I look around. I'm bad at tests. Then my eyes fall on a chunky, moss-covered limestone megalith, leaning into the bank among the undergrowth. It's not finely quarried, but its relatively straight sides and corners and the curved section cut out at one end make it likely that humans have worked on it. It's over 9 feet in length, about 2 feet wide, and something more than a foot thick, almost big enough to stand in at Avebury or Stonehenge as a replacement for one of the smaller megaliths there. "Do you mean this megalith?" I ask. "We'll come to that," says Ross, "but look past the megalith. Look above it. I see a cliff." "But do you see a face in the cliff?" The moment Ross says the word face, everything swings into focus for me. It's not a human face, but a serpent's face. That overhang is an upper jaw. There's a line of a mouth below it. Above the corner of the mouth, to the right, much darker than the rest of the face, a distinct eye seems to gaze down at us. In later research, I'll find that many visitors have noticed the resemblance of this completely natural outcrop to the head of a serpent. In 1919, for example, Charles Willoughby of Harvard University's Peabody Museum visited Serpent Mound and concluded, "The site chosen for this great effigy was probably determined largely by superstitions, which may have been connected with the headland upon which it was built. This headland, rising to a height of about 100 feet, gradually narrows and terminates in a cliff, bearing a certain resemblance to the head of a reptile. The contour of the head, the muzzle, the eye, and mouth are clearly indicated. The Indians may also have seen in the promontory extending backward from the head along the shore of Bush Creek the body of the serpent deity. Natural formations, peculiarly shaped stones, concretions, and other objects resembling human or animal forms or any of their parts were generally supposed to possess supernatural powers, and in this instance, with little imagination, one can easily approach the Indians' point of view. Earlier, in 1886, archaeologist W. H. Holmes came away from Serpent Mound with a similar impression. having the idea of a great serpent in the mind, he wrote in Science. One is at once struck with the remarkable contour of the bluff, and especially of the exposure of rock, which readily assumes the appearance of a colossal reptile lifting its front from the bed of the stream. The head is the point of rock, the dark, lip-like edge is the muzzle, the light-colored underside is the white neck, the caves are the eyes, and the projected masses to the right are the protruding coils of the body. The varying effects of light must greatly increase the vividness of the impressions, and nothing would be more natural than that the Sylvan prophet should recognize this likeness and should at once regard the promontory as a great Manitou. His people would be led to regard it as such, and the celebration of feasts upon the point would readily follow. With a mound-building people, this would result in the erection of suitable enclosures and in the elaboration of the form of the reptile, that it might be the more real. The natural and the artificial features must all have related to one and the same conception. The point of naked rock was probably at first and always recognized as the head of both the natural and the modified body. It was, to the Indian, the real head of the great serpent Manitou. We're still standing by the megalith that first caught my attention. What about this, I ask? Is this part of the Serpent Mound story or just a random chunk of rock? Ross shrugs. Nobody knows for sure. He pauses before adding, I've got my own theory, though. Which is? I think it's one of the large stones that Squire and Davis reported had stood in the oval earthwork in front of the serpent's head in the 19th century. The ones, they said, had been scattered by some treasure hunter. That's right, Ross replies, and if I recall correctly, they also said those stones had been arranged in a circle before they were thrown down. I know what Ross is reminding me of here is a connection he's written about between the geometry of Stonehenge and the geometry of Serpent Mound, which he regards as two elements comprising a larger picture pointing to a highly evolved school of astro-architecture, the origin of which is not known. Therefore, while he does not dispute that Serpent Mound was the work of Native American geometers and astronomers, he believes that they were members of a much older school, and implementing a much older design, which likewise at many different times and in many different media was brought into commission in many other parts of the world as well. This fundamental, endlessly reiterated, endlessly reincarnated design, he says, seems to have no home base, no specific country or culture responsible for its phenomenon. This, however, is precisely what we would expect if its home base were a lost civilization, destroyed so completely and so deeply buried in time that it has been reduced to the stuff of myths and legends. What the Serpent Sees. In the hour before sunset, as a refreshing chill enters the air, we're back at the upper level of Serpent Mound, with all batteries charged and the drone ready to fly. The sun, which rose north of east this morning, seems already drawn down low on its arc towards its setting point on the northwestern horizon. And again, we notice the effective blinding of the serpent by the dense trees allowed to flourish along its line of sight as a matter of deliberate policy by the Ohio History Connection. It's obvious if we did not have the drone that we would get at best only faint impressions and hints of the alignment if a few scattered sunbeams somehow found their way through the thicket. This isn't how it's supposed to be, I say to Ross. It feels almost like sacrilege. But the good news, he replies, is people are waking up again, here and everywhere else. Regardless of what the Ohio History Connection wants or does, or what the archaeologists tell us we should believe, we're at one of those junctures in the cycle where the Manitou is reactivated as a source of knowledge and wisdom. With a soft buzz of its rotors, Santa's little drone climbs into the sky, and we cluster around the monitor to share the aerial view. It's 7:55 p.m., and from an altitude of 400 feet, uncluttered by trees, we can see that the sun still has some distance to travel before it conjuncts the range of hills forming the local horizon to the northwest. The warm, mellow light of the end of a summer's day, interspersed with patterns of cool, deep shade, dapples the immense earthwork along its entire length, and despite the trees closing in around its head, it seems truly master of its enchanted kingdom. Santha has the drone hovering in place near the back of the serpent's neck, overlooking its open jaws, the great oval, the trees, and the horizon far beyond. It's the perfect shot, but by 8:12 p.m. the glare is so intense that it's difficult to be certain exactly where the sun now sits in relation to the horizon. There's a great scooped-out hollow of silver light there, and the sun's disk is somewhere in the middle of it. A shift in position of the drone, however, confirms that sunset is still some time off. At 8:13 p.m. we bring the device down for a battery change and relaunch it, but just 11 minutes later, at 8:24, the control panel lights up with a low battery warning. The ponderous roll of the Earth towards the east, the majestic descent of the sun towards the west, seem to have synced into a kind of slow-motion dream sequence, and with no alternative, hoping we have not miscalculated the timing of the universe, we bring the drone back to Earth. There's something seriously wrong with it. Not the battery problem, that was easily solved, but something in the communications between the control unit and the little quadcopter. In the 28 minutes it takes to fix it, we can feel the light leaching out of the sky. The evening air grows cool, and the shadows cast by the trees lengthen. The sun's still in the heavens, somewhere, but whether it has dropped behind the hills yet, or whether we'll still have a chance to witness that moment, is completely unclear when the drone finally starts to obey orders again, and we are able to relaunch it at 8:52 p.m. Santha rockets it straight up to 400 feet, to the vantage point she'd found before, and we all give a cheer as we see in the monitor, as though by some miracle, that the sun is indeed still with us, and poised exactly on the rim of the hills that the Hardmans dubbed Solstice Ridge. The next 3 minutes are magical, as the great luminary, source of all life on Earth, begins its final descent into night. It's a transformation, and a transition, rather than an abrupt change of state. The glare that dazzled the camera earlier is much reduced now, and little by little the sky fills with the most seductive soft glow, and the sun's disk seems to excavate a niche in the horizon, where its setting is indeed in very fine alignment with the open jaws of the serpent. There it reclines, seemingly still, shedding its brilliance and beneficence across this golden land of bounteous fields and forests, as though in deep communion with the earth. I'm reminded of a passage from the ancient Egyptian Book of the Dead, a hymn addressed to Ra, the sun god. Men praise thee in thy name Ra, and they swear by thee, for thou art Lord over them. Thou hearest with thine ears, and thou seest with thine eyes. Millions of years have gone over the world. I cannot tell the number of those through which thou hast passed. Thou dost pass over and dost travel through untold spaces, requiring millions and hundreds of thousands of years to pass over. Thou passest through them in peace, and thou steerest thy way across the watery abyss to the place which thou lovest. This thou doest in one little moment of time, and then thou dost sink down and dost make an end of the hours. Over Serpent Mound, the drama continues to unfold. This love affair of planet and star, ground and sky, above and below, this beautiful and moving alignment sustained for a long, lingering interval as the sun continues its descent. Half its disk has disappeared from view now, then three quarters, then just a glimmering, radiant, shimmering sliver somehow enduring on the horizon, and then at last it's gone entirely, but for a warm, all-embracing afterblush that blossoms in the gloaming. Old certainties. If Serpent Mound had been kept clear of trees by the successive cultures that venerated and repeatedly restored the great effigy, then the alignment within the wide spread of the serpent's jaws would always have been a striking feature here from the time of the retreat of the ice sheets more than 13,000 years ago. Because of the shifting tilt of the Earth's axis, however, The exact point on the horizon where the summer solstice sun would set would shift several degrees north and south of its present position over the 41,000-year obliquity cycle. We've already seen how the Hardmans were taken to task in the 1980s for mistakenly proposing a summer solstice sunset alignment at an azimuth as viewed from Serpent Mound that, according to the calculations of their critics Fletcher and Cameron, coincided with a date of 11,000 BC. Archaeologists at the time considered that date far too early for any civilization capable of creating a structure of the scale and complexity of Serpent Mound to have evolved in North America. And accordingly, no further investigation of this rather intriguing anomaly was ever undertaken. The 1980s are long gone, however, and in the 21st century, as we'll see in Part 2, new evidence has emerged that calls all the old certainties into question.